So I gave a talk before on cavity cooling, but it seems that the audience here are quite different communities. So I come from quantum optics, then there are atomic physicists who are already a lot more, use quite different models, and then there are a lot of condensed matter people here. So what I will try to do is to give an introduction in quantum optics. And what is probably the most interesting part, or a very interesting part of quantum optics, is to talk about open quantum systems. So so things that go beyond having a Hamiltonian. And then in order to keep things simple, I think I have problems to follow quite a lot of the condensed matter talks because the language is quite different and just writing things a bit slightly different, and it makes it impossible to follow sometimes. So just ask any time. And so what I thought is I talk about the simplest example we have in quantum optics. So it's not new physics, just basics, laser-driven two-level atom, and then derive master equations for that. And if you have questions, just interrupt any time. Yeah. So the talk will be three parts. Is the first part is so a laser-driven two-level atom. But the thing is, if you can derive master equations for a two-level atom, you can derive it for any quantum optics systems. So I talk a bit about the physics we have there. Then I will talk about quantum jumps. And master equations. And then the third part is, so I'm doing it backwards. The third part is meant to motivate what we are actually doing or why we are doing it. So I will talk about two very crucial quantum optics experiments. In my opinion, the nicest quantum optics experiments, or the most fundamental ones, that motivate a lot of the model that we are using. Okay, so what I will start is, I will start with one. An atom in a trap. I start very basic, but we will speed up a bit. So it's, as I said, it's the simplest model that you can kind of imagine that has an interesting coupling to an environment and that can emit photons. And quantum optics is a lot about atom-photon interactions. Then the first experiments with single atoms. So that is a difference where we have to go beyond quantum mechanics, because what we are doing now is we are describing single quantum systems, not an ensemble of systems. We have a single systems. And experiments with single systems, they became, so that's different from the quantum mechanics that we have had before, that was always making predictions for expectation values. Well, it's not too different either. So this became quite interesting in the 1980s when people started to trap single atoms. So the first traps, they really looked something like that. I mean, yeah, it's maybe a bit too basics after this impressive conference we had here. And then you have, this is more or less what the first traps looked like. So you had some electrodes on the top and then some in the middle, and they are connected in that way that you have some oscillating current. And what you do in this way, you create a potential in which you can trap single atoms, and the potential they created is more or less one like that, or V of R and R. And what happens is that this potential rotates very fast. So you more or less you have something where then the atom can sit in. So you can really trap single atoms or ions. So this is so what they did in the beginning, they had an ion cloud. Yeah. And then what you can also do is you can apply laser fields to really manipulate the inner states of the atoms. And one of the things that can be observed would be one could observe something like a photon statistics. And if you put, I mean, by now the traps look a lot more elegant and you can find of all kinds of trap configurations where you have a lot more time, more space to put lasers and detectors and everything. But more or less what happens when you put a detector that detects photons, then what you would see in time would be really you would have clicks and you would see single clicks at the detector from the photons that are coming out. Yeah. So what we need to do something is we need to find a model that can predict some inner dynamics by the laser that can change the state of the atoms coherently, but at the same time you also have some spontaneous event where you have concrete photon emissions and things like that. So the first experiments were quite a lot on looking, for example, into time correlation functions along these clicks and studying their correlation functions. And for example, by showing that there's always some time between photons, so you cannot have an emission immediately after another emission, means in that way you can prove that you really have exactly one atom in your trap. So you can really do an experiment with a single quantum system. These experiments became very popular again now because they're used in quantum dot experiments to show that you have single photon sources. Yeah? So they look a lot at the statistics of photon emissions and yeah. Okay.
So is it different from, I mean, I'm confessing my question, but is it different from fluorescence resonance?
No, this is exactly. Yeah, so you can.
Jeff Campbell's experiment.
Oh, there are a lot of people. So the first experiments, this trapping a single atom, were in the 1980s, and Kimball is already almost the next generation. And then you can, instead of single atoms, he's mainly doing experiments with single atoms in the cavity, but that system is more or less equivalent. I can say. If you want, I can say a little bit about cavities also at the end and how to model, how they fit in this model.
These peaks are on top of the laser background?
These are not peaks. What I just want to mark time, you have a detector, and then the detector gives you a signal, and it says click, and then you know there was a photon with some probe.
I guess the question is, why don't you see the background laser?
So what you could do is you could have the laser really going in another direction. There are always some dark counts, but that can be quite well suppressed. So, that was a bit, I was drawing it badly, pointing us in this direction. But this is mainly the situation. You have something that you can, like a laser would be the easiest thing to manipulate the inner state of the atoms, we will see in a second. But then you also want to model something where you have spontaneous events and things like that.
But is the laser frequency the same as the spontaneous emission?
I come to this in a second. We don't need to assume that they are the same. But the biggest effects are when they are in resonance.
But if they are the same, how do you tell whether it's from emission or elastic scattering?
What is elastic scattering then?
Yeah, that is the question. Let's postpone this question a bit more later, because I think there's a lot of semi-classical language also that people use for describing laser, and I think it's not really necessary. So people often talk about stimulated emission and absorption and spontaneous absorption, and I think it's a bit misleading sometimes. Okay, so what we can do now is let's get more down to more concrete. But this is kind of setting the stage of what we want to describe. So the next thing is quantum jumps and master equations. So as I said, the main thing I want to do is derive master equations. But in quantum optics, for modeling single systems, what we use very often is the quantum jump approach. And it's much easier to derive quantum jump approach first and then to pitch that together and make a mass equations out of that. So that's why I will start with quantum jumps. So what we do is, so what we have here actually in a good approximation is something, we have a system, to make it in a more condensed matter language. Then this system couples to a bus. And that bus is the quantized radiation field, where you have a free radiation field surrounding the system. But then what you also have is that box does not exist in free space. So you also have an environment that does something to the bus. Yeah? So but what we will start with is we will start with the system bus interaction. So the Hamiltonian we have is the sum of an atom term plus a laser term plus then we have the radiation field. So because we want to model photon emission, so the photons have to live somewhere. But then we have also have to have an interaction between the atom and the field. The atom term is the easiest one because that is just h bar omega 0, 1, 1. And that is the case when I say I have a two-level system, I have a ground state 0 and an excited state 1, and then I just assume that the energy difference here is h bar omega 0. Yeah? So that's not the laser frequency, that's of the atom. And then we usually, in quantum optics, we always use Dirac notation instead of writing sigma plus sigma minus, but it is the same. More interesting is the laser term. And what is usually assumed is that the laser field is like a field that is a classical field. It consists of so many photons, and they're all kind of hanging together. So the way I describe it to the students most of the time is saying, that you have the atom there, then the laser comes, and what it does, it creates an electric field that oscillates in time. And the electron in the atom sees this oscillation. Yeah, but it's not putting light into the atom and taking light out. So we treat the laser always in a classical way. And what we have is a dipole interaction. It's x times e laser of t. So we have the electron. That is an electron that goes around the atom, and depending on where it is, it sees a different force or in the laser field. Then what we do is, so E is really the charge of the electron. Then what you do is, since we are only interested in the position of the electron, when the electron is either in the ground state or the excited state, I multiply with the 1, then I have the position operator, then I multiply again with the 1. And then we have the laser term, which would be something like a classical field E0 e to the I omega laser t plus some complex conjugated. Yeah? So this is where we really start from a dipole-dipole interaction. And what we do now is we notice that when you have a potential in the atom that is kind of has some certain symmetry, then multiplying an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian with x changes the symmetry. You either have symmetric or antisymmetric energy eigenstates, and multiplying with x turns a symmetric state into an antisymmetric one and an antisymmetric one into a symmetric one. So that means the matrix element 0, x, 0 has to be 0. Yeah. So the only thing we have left is the matrix elements where we have actually mix different photons, different electron states. So we get a contribution, for example, when I multiply this term with that term. So I get a 0 x 1 times 0 1 plus, and then I get the Hermitian conjugated when I multiply this one with that one. And then what I also have to put in is the matrix element itself, and that we can call that the dipole moment of the atom.
X, you mean the quantized operator A plus A dagger or something like that?
Yeah, it's just a position, the normal position operator for, we don't need to quantize the motion at that point, just the usual. And then we multiply that also with E0 e to the I omega laser t. So here the laser is the laser frequency plus the complex conjugated. So we get this after making... I should make it like this. I thought it was missing. Exactly, that's a matrix element. What Victor taught me to really explain it on a basic level, where I say how we do rotating wave approximations. So what we do now is when we multiply here every term with every other term, then we get four terms. But some of them are oscillating with e to the I omega laser t, and then you have the same term again oscillating with e to the minus I omega laser t. So what we do is we skip some of the terms, and that is called the rotating wave approximation. So what we are left is, this is, we put all the constants, like this would depend on which atom you have. We just put this together in some, summarize all of this in some Rabi frequency omega. And then to make it more convenient, we write it as 1/2 H bar omega. And then, so this comes from here, multiplied already with the laser amplitude. So what this Rabi frequency is, it tells you how strong does the laser actually drive the atom. And that would be multiplied with 0, 1, e to the I omega laser t. And then I have the same term again with e to the minus I omega laser t. But I skip this one because I can then go into an interaction picture where this term would oscillate with frequency 0 and the other one would go with 2 omega laser t. So and everything that oscillates fast is left away because it would contribute 1 over 2 omega L to the time evolution operator, and that is a very small contribution. That's why things that oscillate very fast, much faster than the time evolution that is then later happening on this time scale, is left away.
You mean not the Hermitian conjugate, you mean the cross product terms.
So I don't skip the Hermitian conjugated, but I leave out this term where it has the e to the minus I omega laser t dependence. Then another trick is that we do often is we assume that this is real. So normally you would say the dipole moment multiplied with some complex field, it should give a complex frequency. Well, what happens is you can always put the phase factor into this state, and then it's gone. So you can always assume that it's real. If you get really many complicated composite quantum system, then it becomes more. Then you have to be careful. But normally you have enough components whose states you can redefine so that everything remains real.
How is it different from hydrogen atoms in the electric field and qualitatively?
Nothing different. I'm not doing anything new today. I tried the last time, so today I'm doing old stuff. But this is the model that's used to describe any atom in quantum optics. Yeah.
What makes you to use the classical approximation for the what's the criterion here?
That's the students ask me this also all the time. And No, it's to be honest, the only thing I can say, it fits very well with the experiments. Actually, I think it should be condensed metaphysics answer this question.
The radius divided by the wavelength of the laser is pretty small. That's the criteria.
Okay, yeah.
But it has to depend on the intensity of the laser,
right?
Yeah.
This is what I suspect.
No, that is, let's say, that defines the area of quantum optics. So really, in the optical regime, Yeah. So in any quantum optics experiments, you don't get into that regime where this where anything else matters. And then the field that concerns where omega is so strong that, that you really change what happens in the atom, that, that's an intense laser fields. That's a different type of.
Maybe there's a little bit of quantum optics behind this assumption. I mean, if you're saying that the laser is well described by a coherent state, so that
yeah,
you're
okay.
taking
yeah.
a photon out of it, you leave it in the same state. And that in quantum optics means it's an eigenvalue of the destruction operator, and that means it's a coherent state.
Yeah.
So I think a laser in particular creates a field that is well described by a coherent state. Classical, a light bulb doesn't. And so it's important that this is H laser, not H light bulb.
Yeah.
Okay, and so I think there's a little quantum optics behind it. You're creating
yeah,
a coherent
yeah.
state with a large number. It's a good, it's to a very good approximation, it's a coherent state.
Hmm. Yeah, Kimball did an experiment at some point where he had some teleportation and with coherent states, and then people were arguing whether that's real or not. And then people did the analysis, I think, with coherent states, and it worked out.
This is always confusing, right? Is it actually the classical limit of quantum optics in the sense that you have another limit in which you have a few photons, which the quantum is much
Yeah, this
smaller.
Is only true for large photon numbers.
It's almost like you treat it like a yeah. classical variable, right? Like a water parameter.
So it's really, it's a laser, yeah, sorry.
If you want to explain that distillation, that will be fine.
Yeah.
If you want to explain revival and dying of the radio distillation, that's not me. No, you have to quantize that field.
Yeah, now that's what we do next. So that is part of these two terms.
Just to clarify a little bit, if mm-hmm. I really take an incoherent light,
yeah.
then I have to write the electric field in terms of oscillating term plus random traces. Is that how is it different from laser physics?
Yeah, then you would write a sum. So here we assume a field with just one
yeah.
frequency, and then you would have the sum over many.
Yeah. But the first part, like a dipole coupling, are still the same, right?
Yeah. So what would change would be here the frequency here, and then you can have this also time dependent. Yeah. So. So more or less, it's something easy left. It's something that excites and de-excites the atom. So in order now to take spontaneous emission into account, we need to talk about the quantized free radiation field. That means the field which then carries the photons that are spontaneously emitted. And that is the sum over k lambda, h bar omega k, ak lambda, dagger ak lambda. Yeah. So what we assume is that the field is quantized, I think there. And then what we need in addition is the interaction between the atom and this free radiation field. And there we do exactly the same trick. We assume again that we have a dipole approximation. So now the atom is the dipole of the atom is interacting with the free radiation field. And the field, so I should put field here. So that's no longer the laser. And this field term is R dependence, depending, and it's given by I. Then I have a sum over all the different k. So these are all the different wave factors of the photons that can exist in the radiation field. And then I have lambda equals 1 and 2. So there are some assumptions that you can then find in the quantum optics books. So we assume that this is a kind of a superconducting box where the E field vanishes on the surface of this box. And then you do the limit that of making this box larger and larger. And then the free radiation field becomes a continuous spectrum of modes. Lambda is the, so for each K vector, we also have a polarization vector that can have two different values. Then there is a constant that is h bar omega k over 2 epsilon 0 l to the third. And l is the volume, l to the third is the volume of the box, or l is the length of the box. And then we have a polarization vector that is orthogonal on K. Then we have a creation operator, AK lambda, e to the I KR minus the emission conjugated. So that would be the observable for the field.
So what makes it important here to keep something like the position dependence in your E field while you neglected the small effects from the laser from the start?
Because the experiments I talk about later, there it matters. I take it out in a second, but I want to have it here for. It's also for the cooling I was talking about. What we do there is then we quantize this frequency treat this as an operator. And then we get the coupling to the fault. If you want to get that's for the laser. You then do. Okay. We can neglect that for the moment. So what we can then do is we can now calculate what this is. So we get an E. We know already that when I multiply this with 1 and 1, then we get something like 0x1. So a matrix element times 0, 1 plus the Hermitian conjugated. And then I get times I get times E field. And if I want, we can say that the atom sits at the position R equals 0, and then we have it nicer.
Last question.
Yeah?
So here you use this longitudinal X for the E.
So yeah.
Otherwise, use a P dot A.
Yeah.
Compare which
way is the That's a good question. If you go a bit back in time and you take a quantum optics experiment book that is like, let's say, 30 years old, then you find lots of discussions about exactly what difference does that. Like Mandel-Wolf would be an example where the book is just that big. And then they found out that the difference, whether you take E times D or P times A, is not. It's more or less equivalent, and they discuss what. So there is a small term, P squared over A or something, that is the difference, and you can show that it's very small in the. So it's really like what we're doing is quantum optics, and in quantum optics, it's more or less like a definition of the field where the difference doesn't matter.
So the magnetic term river showed up, something advanced.
I think if you do P dot A, it will include the magnetic field.
The diameter.
Yeah.
Because you know, you know that since there is to be smaller.
Also, the P dot A contribute by the magnetic dipole, but those terms are always very small, even the intensity is very large.
I've seen discussions of it. I mean, now it's standard that everyone assumes this D times E coupling. Only when you go really to intense laser fields where you have very, very strong pulses, very short, very high frequencies, then you make a.
But here, how strong has to be?
It's probably done by a factor of V over C, V is the typical velocity of the.
But if the 0 and 1 stay, there's no dipole, I mean, the matrix element equals 0, then you.
Yeah, then you would not do this experiment with it. So you always keep, you take some state, you always put your laser close to some states where the transition is not dipole forbidden or not forbidden by selection rules.
That's why it's sufficient.
Yeah, and also, I mean, you could calculate exactly from quantum mechanics what this overlap of this state with that state is and what the dipole matrix element is. But at the end, what they do in an experiment, they put their laser and then they measure the intensity. I mean, you probably know better as the only experimentalist here. Oh, it's something that is just measured at the end. What people just measure is the Rabi frequency and the decay rates, and then.
This interaction term is the interaction between the field and the atom. Is that right?
Yeah, yeah. So
for the laser, between laser and the atom, that's already included.
Yeah, that is the term that I just removed. So we have done this term, this term, and now I did this term we did, and now we do the last term. So what we.
Laser interact with the field?
No.
Because both are electromagnetic.
But there's no exchange. There's no interaction between photons, so there's no exchange. So these are like two different types of.
So one you treat it quantized, another laser you treat it classically.
Yeah, but this is what I'm doing is I have an atom trapped in free field, and then I have a laser coming from one direction, but I know that photons can be emitted in another direction. So I have a dipole coupling to this mode in the box, so to say, or let's say this mode in the box, while the laser puts only puts a classical field here. Yeah. So what I want to do is I want to describe really the spontaneous emission of photons. So there are two different types of fields I have. One that makes the atom oscillate, and one that can then is normally in a vacuum state, one field, and where I can create a photon.
I think the confusion is that if you think about this as a steady state system,
yeah,
there's always an incoming wave and scattered wave.
Yeah.
Right? And so we usually treat them on equal footing. Here, somehow you are.
I come to that.
It was treated like a
classical freedom, but that's why it's coherent.
I come to that in more detail.
The thing about the quantum wave is like a quantum photon field in the background, like the UQ, separate the beam field from the quantum fluctuation problem. Because they condense very nicely.
Okay, yeah. So what we do again here next is we put everything together. So as I said, for the moment we don't really need to care how big the constants really are. We know that we have a coupling of the single atom. So whenever I de-excite the atom, I create excitation in the free radiation field, and I have a coupling to all the different modes. And I just call this coupling constant GK lambda. Okay, and then we have plus emission conjugated. So this is, and this is again in the rotating wave approximation. Then we assume that the atom sits at R equals to zero to make it simpler. And I could write down what the coupling constant is. So this GK lambda is equal to IE square root of h bar omega k over 2 epsilon 0 L to the third. So that comes from the quantization of the mode. And then epsilon k lambda. And then this matrix element 1x0. Yeah. OK, so now we have all the terms.
So this is the sum of k times omega.
No. So the omega is really the inter. So we have different components here. We really have an atom. Then we have the laser, and then we have the free radiation field. And if you want, we describe the laser at the moment by omega, and the coupling of the atom to the radiation field by this GK lambda. And then we also have these terms, but they vanish then. So I removed this part. So what we do next is, so this is actually more quantum field theory at the moment, but that's how we derive the tools for quantum optics. So what we do now is we go in an interaction picture. And the interaction picture we choose normally is the one where we say H0 equals H atom plus H field. So we really go into a frame where we have really only the interaction terms. And as we said, Sorry, I should write it. There's a little trick. We go to something that is close to the interaction-free Hamiltonian. We assume that is H bar omega laser 1-1. So I'm not taking exactly the energy of the atom. I take something that has the energy, an upper level that has the energy of the laser, plus sum over, plus H field. And the main reason for assuming this frequency is that I want a laser. I want a time-independent Hamiltonian, so I want to get rid of the time dependence of this laser Hamiltonian. And if we do this, what we get is a nice interaction Hamiltonian. So these are the terms I need to take. So that's just the usual way of going into an interaction picture. And what we are left with is a term that is 1/2 h bar omega 0,1 plus the emission conjugated, which is now the time-independent laser term. Then we get a term that comes from subtracting the atom term, but not exactly at the right frequency. So we get a term h bar delta times 1,1. This delta equals 2 omega 0 minus omega laser. So that's the tuning of the laser. And then we also get a term that is the sum of all the k lambda, h bar gk lambda star 0,1 ak lambda. And then now I have some time dependence here that is omega 0 minus omega k times t plus Hermitian conjugate. And from this you can see already that the biggest probability is that we, or the highest probability is that we create photons who have exactly the frequency of the atom. Yeah? So this is the...
This free radiation field, is it?
Yeah.
Do you consider this coherent or
incoherent? I come to this at the moment. So what we described now is we really have described the system bus coupling via Hamiltonian, yeah? And that is the Hamiltonian that we can use for that. It will become incoherent. I'm not, I have that in mind, this part. So what we have now is we have a Hamiltonian that whenever the atom is excited, the atom can transfer excitation into the radiation field in all modes. So I don't make any assumptions that these are, so this is a really coherent transfer. And the atom can transfer its excitation into any mode where it has it, where it couples to in all directions. Yeah? And the strongest interaction is when the frequency is close to the frequency of the atom. So what happens is, in a more modern language, you would say what this Hamiltonian does, it entangles the state of the atom with all the modes of the free radiation field. So you put excitation everywhere. So what comes next is we have to take the effect of the environment into account. And because we need to make a link between what we actually see in the experiment and namely spontaneous events, and we have a Hamiltonian that does something that is coherent. And the way that is done is by assuming that the effect of the environment, or if you want, the walls of the laboratory, is that you have measurements whether photons are in your radiation field or not. Because what you can always imagine is that when you do your experiment, you have some wall here, and then you have a photon coming, hitting the wall, and it will get stuck there. It will make a click or something, and it will never come back and re-excite the atom again. The difficulty now is we cannot make... Quantum mechanics does not have something that is exactly continuous measurements. So the assumption we do here at this point is that we have a coarse-grained time scale, and on this coarse-grained time scale, we measure whether there are photons in the radiation field or not. And that gives us then exactly effects. Then we are allowed to have this kind of spontaneous events. We have like spontaneous photon emissions. And a confirmation that this is a good assumption is that later it does not matter what coarse graining we assumed. Yeah. So the time scales that we consider for this coarse graining, they drop out of the model and they're not part of the model. So it doesn't matter exactly what your lab looks like, and the experiments you do are always exactly the same. So let me write. So we keep this in mind. So this was to describe the effect of the coupling of the atom to the bus.
Physically, if you do this experiment, like a Duncan experiment, you have one atom in the cap, and you use laser to try to map your oscillations. And you have to decay, which either due to the environment or due to the membrane.
Yeah.
Which one's more important in the radical situation, which one?
No, we model both. It will be both as in the model. Everything fits very well. We don't need to say this is more important than that.
So you need to take it out both simultaneously to understand.
Yeah, give me a second for, so now it becomes more quantum optics. You will see then in a, so up to now it was more quantum field theory, and a lot of people who worked on quantum optics, I mean, they were closely related to, or did also work on quantum field theory. So what we do now is, in order to model the environment, we assume this rapidly repeated measurements. So we assume that we have, we introduce some new time scale. So we have some time t, and then we assume some, let's say, we can start at time zero where our system is in a atom is in a certain state, the free radiation field is in a vacuum. So let's say we have psi and no photons. And then we look at the time interval delta t, and we say, here we have the effect of the Hamiltonian, so here we have ui of delta t and zero. And at this point, we do a measurement. Yeah. So you have, either you have a click or no click. When I started looking into working on quantum optics, I was interested in the measurement process. And at that time, you found articles where people were saying, who is doing these measurements? Do we really need an observer? So what we normally do is we call this environment-induced measurements, and they happen anyway. They're induced by the environment. Just that, because you cannot avoid that your bus does also couple to something else, to the environment. Yeah. And what you can ask then is, you can now ask two different questions. What happens if I have no photon emission, and what happens when I have a photon emission? And in quantum optics, we are not really interested in what exactly happens in the bus. We're interested in how can we manipulate this atom and what happens to the atom. So we're interested in the state of the atom only, and we want master equations that describe the atom. So what I can do now is I can ask for the no photon evolution. Yeah? So I say, I look at what is the state of the system under the condition that I didn't have a photon emission. So we start with a state psi and no photons, and then we evolve with the Hamiltonian that I derived before, the one that entangles the atom with the free radiation field. But now we're only interested in the state where I find no photons in the system. And I call this, so I use the von Neumann, just the usual stuff, I use a projector onto the no photon state. And it means the state I have at that moment is something like the state of the atom under the condition of no photon, if you want that delta t, and zero photons. Yeah. That means, and what I can do now is I can look at, this is the important expression that, or the operator that actually changes the state of the atom. So I call this u cont of delta t and zero, which is a conditional time evolution operator. Yeah. So this is the operator that changes the state of the atom, and what I have is the state under the condition of no photon emission is u cont applied to this. And what we can do is we can now calculate this expression easily by using second order perturbation theory. So this is I don't want to go into detail there because that you can easily read in the books. I want to give mainly also the overview. And this is, I guess, also more standard. The reason that we need second-order perturbation theory is that what we need is, or you get contributions from terms where the atom transmits a photon, creates a photon in the free radiation field, but then this also needs to be reabsorbed. And then you get some damping terms that correspond to photon emissions. So the conditional Hamiltonian, we also get a contribution from the first order, which is the normal terms in the Hamiltonian. So what we have is that psi 0 of delta t is a uconc of delta t and 0 applied to psi. And the Hamiltonian that corresponds to this time evolution operator is 1 half h bar omega times 0, 1. So that is the term that we had before that does not change the state of the orders. It's just a laser interaction. Then we have the term that comes from the detuning. And then we also get a term which is interesting. Maybe it deserves another color. So minus I over 2 h bar gamma times 1. And this is the term that comes from second order perturbation theory and comes from the interaction with the environment. So this is really, so what we have here is a non-Hermitian Hamiltonian.
Gamma, what is gamma?
And gamma is now the decay rate of the system. So what gamma is something that depends on this decay lambda. You can calculate what it is. It's something like e squared 0x 1 squared omega 0 to the third over 6p epsilon 0 h bar c to the third. So this is really the spontaneous decay rate. So this is the rate with which an atom emits a photon if it's in the excited state.
This is due to the coupling of the system to the bus, not so much to the environment.
To the bus. Or to the free radiation field, to be more concrete. And that comes from second order. And the reason that this is the non-Hermitian Hamiltonian is not so surprising because when I do a projection, then there's a probability that I don't get that state. So what this time evolution operator does, it reduces the state of the norm of a state vector. But what we have is that, I put this here, that the modulus squared of the state at time t, so uconc of t and 0, psi, modulus squared, that this is the probability for having no photon in a certain time interval. Yeah. So instead of looking only at one time interval, I can now look at many time intervals beyond each other. Then always the system evolves with this conditional Hamiltonian. So this is the probability for no photon. Yeah. So what I can do now is we can look at a simple example, and everything else will. I'm not sure how much time I have spent already.
15 minutes.
Okay, yeah, no, then we are good. So the important thing is we can derive a Hamiltonian that describes the time evolution of the system only under the condition of no photon emission, but it has quite a lot of information in it. What I will do now is I give a simple example that you see what you can do with this method. Then we can look off the case, what happens when you have a photon emission, which will be also very short. And then we can see how that gets, when you put this together, how you get master equations, the usual master equations. Okay, so let me give you an example.
So the laser will not cause decay?
No, so what the laser does. Let me draw this quickly, the Rabi oscillations. Yeah, let's shortly say something about the laser. So if you have gamma equal to 0 and omega not equal to 0, then what your Hamiltonian is would be 1 half h bar omega, also this conditional Hamiltonian, 0, 1 plus plus the emission conjugated, and then we have the term H bar delta 1-1. And what that means is that if you solve this time evolution and you write down, for example, the population in the excited state, and it just oscillates. And this is what is called Rabi oscillations. And if you have a detuning, so here this is delta equals 0 and 1, of course. And if you have a detuning, then this oscillations become a bit longer, and you don't go up to the 1 anymore. And the thing is, when you now have spontaneous emission, then what happens is that your oscillations get even a bit longer. And whenever you have excitation in the excited state, then you can have suddenly a photon emission. So you can have, what you get is random trajectories. And what you can do with this method is more or less predict all the possible trajectories analytically and then analyze them in detail. So the laser, yeah?
So this is when the atom has emission of photons?
Yeah, then you would have jumps.
And then if you put many plots on top of each other, you see envelope, that's
how. Yeah, so what we describe as mass equation is only averaging over many trajectories. So with the quantum jump approach, you can make simulations of the possible trajectories, and then with mass equations, you get the ensemble average.
Experimentally, how do you see the jump? You just by counting the photon?
Yeah.
Photon coming out means the jump.
Yeah. So the jump happens also if it's not recorded, because the environment records it, but yeah, you could. Okay, it's too philosophical, probably. For example, we use this method a lot for quantum computing, because what in quantum computing, you're interested in a coherent time evolution, and normally you're interested in a coherent evolution in a system that also emits photons. So you could use this approach of calculating the time evolution under the condition that is not emitting a photon, and then you can find methods that give you the probability that you have no emission. For example, using a Zeno effect, you make the probability that you have an emission equal close to 1, and then you have a nice implementation for quantum computing in an open quantum system. So you really use this approach when you're interested in conditional time evolutions, but it's also the easiest way of deriving mass equations that give ensemble averages.
So the Zeno effect is a conditional evolution, isn't it?
Or you could use measurements to make the probability that you don't have an emission equal to 1, because if your system is constantly measured in an indirect way, then it wouldn't emit photons, and that would be the method to show that you really have no photon emissions.
Can I ask a question?
Mm-hmm.
Here, we have a driving force on the external laser field at the frequency omega. In response, the oncoming frequency can be shifted to this omega square plus another square.
Yeah.
Algebra is clear. But conceptually, suppose we have a harmonic oscillator, you have a driving force.
Yeah.
The response usually is the same as the driving force, the internal frequency.
So this time scale that we have here is not a time scale that is given by the frequency of the energy of the atom, but it's given by the laser strength.
Non-linear.
Yeah. So you really have a laser field that oscillates, and then the atom starts oscillating with a frequency that is proportional to the strength of the laser, not to the frequency. Yeah? Or let's say this time interval from here to here would be pi over omega, or probably 2 pi over omega. Yeah.
So this is not the ordinary simple force harmonic oscillator.
No. So you need that the laser has a frequency that is close to the frequency of the atom in order to get the effect at all. So you get the oscillation up to really between from one level to the other only if the laser is in resonance with the atom. If it's not in resonance, you don't get to the maxima. And if it's far away, you don't see anything. But then the time scale on which it happens is depends on the strength of the laser. Yeah? Okay. So the main reason I put the laser in was not to confuse you, but to have a tool that can excite the atom. But mainly we're interested in what happens when the atom is actually excited. So just to have one example of what you can do with this conditional Hamiltonian. So let's say we have a laser, an atom that is at time equals to zero in a superposition of a ground state and an excited state. So, and what we want to have is alpha squared plus beta modulo squared equals 1. So I start with a normalized state. And then if I have no laser, then the conditional Hamiltonian would be just minus I over 2 h bar gamma 1 1. It means I can easily calculate what the state of the system is under time t, at the time t, under the condition of not emitting a photon. So that's e to the minus 1 half gamma t. Yeah. So I get, this is alpha times 0, because 0 is a 0 eigenstate of the Hamiltonian, plus beta e to the minus 1 half gamma t times 1. And then I have to renormalize the state if I want to have the real state of the system under the condition of no photon emission. And that means that the probability of seeing no photon up to a time t equals alpha modulo squared plus beta modulo squared e to the minus gamma t. Yeah? That means if I, if the atom is in the ground state, then the probability that you don't get a photon is equal to 1. That you, yeah. And if you are in the excited state and you have an exponential decay with, with gamma, so gamma is really, so this 1 half gamma in the conditional Hamiltonian is chosen in a way that this is really the probability density for an emission when you are in the excited state. Or, in other words, it's a spontaneous decay rate. And then if you, what you could do is you could take the derivative and calculate what's the probability to have a photon at any time, probability density, and it's the population in the excited state times gamma. So it's also what you expect. Okay, so let's make it complete. And then normally you have this photon emissions superimposed with the Rabi oscillation by the laser. So we can also now ask what happens if we have a photon. And let's say we have a, we look again at the small time interval delta t and see what happens when we have a photon. And in this case, we would have to apply the projector that projects onto having a photon in whatever mode in the radiation field. Zero photon psi. And then again, what we can see is we can calculate this term. And this is normally done by using first order perturbation theory. And if you do that, then you will see that this term, what it does, the atom, the photon field gets excited. But whenever we have a term in the Hamiltonian that excites the photon field, then it de-excites the atom. So if I don't care about the normalization, so what I get is an atom in the ground state. And then you can calculate it. So what we do is we have a reset operator. So that is equal to 0. So you get a term 0, 1 psi, and then some constant here. So mainly, whenever you have an emission, you're in the ground state. I mean, for a single atom, that's exactly what you expect. When you have more complicated systems where you have like two atoms and then any of them can emit, then it becomes more complicated. But okay, and if you do the the calculations correctly, then the probabilities for an emission are also exactly the same that you get from the no photon time evolution. So what we have done now is to put this together to master equations, but that's now quite easy because what master equations are is they are the they are describing an ensemble of atoms, and they're more or less just the the averaging over different trajectories that I could get. So if I have some master equations, we look at an ensemble of atoms, and then some of them might emit in one direction. Some of them, if I look at a small time delta t, emit in some other direction, so I have different sub-ensembles. And then also have a sub-ensemble with no photons. Yeah, that means what I can do now is I can say I have rho of 0 at time t equals to 0, and then I can ask what is the density matrix at a time delta t. And we can calculate that easily. And what we get is some u cont of delta t and 0 rho u cont dagger of delta t and 0. And the thing is, I don't need to renormalize this, because this is also already, so this is the ensemble of atoms, so to say, that has not emitted a photon. So the way of, so what master equations describe is two situations. Either you have really many atoms in here, and you look at the average of what happens to each of them on average, or you make many repetitions of the same experiment and ask on average how many photons are in the excited, or what is the state of the system averaged over many trajectories. And this would be the state of the subensemble that has not emitted photons. And the state of the subensemble that emitted photon would be gamma times delta t, because that's the probability to emit. Then we need the population in the excited state, and everything that has emitted is in a ground state. Yeah? And when once I have written this, then I can calculate what is the time derivative of this, and then we get rho dot equals minus I over h4 h cont rho minus rho h cont dagger plus gamma, and then we can write it in a different way, 0, 1, rho, 1, 0. And this is the master equation. And the normal way, if I want to write it in Lindblad form, then I define this reset operator, and I can also say this is equal to minus I over h bar h laser comma rho. And then we get the term here that is something like plus gamma times r rho r dagger minus 1/2 gamma r dagger r rho minus 1/2 gamma rho r dagger r. That would be the usual Lindblad form of the mass equation. So it's all equivalent. But the main point is what you do with mass equations, you describe an ensemble and an average over many ensembles.
What is the advantage of putting it in this Lindblad form? Is there any...
It's more... there is no advantage of putting it this way. One way of describing master equations, a different one to what we do here, is actually to say what are the constraints that I have to put in order to make it a differential equation for a density matrix. And then mathematicians, they would derive, use something like that. And then you can also say the equation has to be of this form, and now I give an interpretation to the constants in here. So first there was this form, and then there were more discussion about the interpretation. So I did it the other way around, and it's much easier to derive it that way. But this is the more known version. If I have 2 more minutes, I can at least mention some experiments that are motivating this. So no more equations. And then we stop, or we can also stop now. It's,
maybe 5 minutes.
Yeah, maybe 2 is even enough there. Because now, since I promised something that's not so formal, then
quantum jumps is the same thing as atoms emitting photons?
Yeah, yeah, that's exactly the same.
Why do you use this fancy name, quantum jump?
I wanted to explain that now. So thanks for the questions. Good timing. So they call it the quantum jump approach because there was a lot of discussion on quantum jumps. And quantum jumps are exactly where you have a system that behaves, that instead of evolving coherently like with a Schrödinger equation, it suddenly changes its state. And there was a lot of discussion in the beginning of quantum mechanics between, for example, there's a famous debate between Schrödinger and Bohr. So Schrödinger had his wave equations, and there's no space for anything like a quantum jump. But Bohr had a bit of different, he was closer to Heisenberg, of course. And also he probably knew a lot of experiments very well where they looked into the spectrum of the emission from an atom. So he had his famous model where they had the electrons moving on fixed radius around the nuclei. So he wanted the states of the electrons to be very quantized, and then they suddenly jump onto another level when they are heated, for example, and they emit. So this fitted more into his model, and Schrödinger didn't fit at all in Schrödinger's picture. So one of the things you can do is, for example, you can do what you could do with an atom is you could observe these quantum jumps. And you cannot really observe the single clicks. Well, one of the things what people did is in one of the experiments, Demelt proposed that. Demelt. So there would be macroscopic quantum jumps. And that's why this approach is called quantum jump approach, because it was mainly developed, for example, to make exactly predictions for these macroscopic quantum jump experiments. And what they did is they have an atom in the ground state and an atom in an excited state, and you drive it very quickly with a laser, and then, of course, it emits a lot of photons. So what this is like putting a laser on an atom, you also measure whether the atom's in the ground state or it is in a state where it does not see the laser. Yeah, so you could describe that as a measurement process. And if you put a weak driving here, some weak laser or some field, then what you see in the fluorescence in time would be something that the atom emits either. So you, when you see photons, you know definitely that you are here and you see lots of photons. But then suddenly the signal goes that for a really long time, because there's always a small chance that you actually find your atom here. And if in this small time interval delta t you don't see a photon emission, then if you don't see a photon, it becomes more and more likely that your atom is actually there. Yeah? So the no photon time evolution then projects the atom into this state. And then because you measure all the time it is in this state, it will stay there for a really long time. So here you are in 2. But then at some point, because it's not an ideal measurement, you have some driving here, it will jump back and start oscillating again. And that's one of the effects that the blinking of a single atom that they saw in, I think in 1986, they actually did this kind of experiment and they saw this telegraph signal. And that was a much stronger proof that you have really a single atom in your trap, in your system. And you can use this also to measure. You can use the same effect construct system where this is, for example, an entangled state. And then you have a very strong tool for preparation of entangled states, because you just drive your system continuously. Suddenly it falls into an entangled state. You know you have prepared your system in the entangled state that you want, and then you turn off your laser and it stays there. So you can play quite a lot with this kind of effect.
Is this really for single atom or ensemble?
No, that would be you can play games like this by putting 2 atoms in the cavity and then looking at the emissions that come out of the cavity. Yeah. But then on the other hand, this is, as I said before, the 2-level atom is just one simplest system you can have in quantum optics. When you have a cavity, then what you have is you would have a system that has excitation or no excitation inside the cavity, and sometimes it might leak out. So you could derive a quantum jump approach exactly the same way for the cavity field. So for example, if you call this mode B, then your conditional Hamiltonian for the cavity would be, for example, your James Cummings Hamiltonian for atoms interacting with the cavity, and then you get a term minus I over 2 H bar kappa B dagger B, and that would be the term that describes the decay from the cavity. And then you can do derive mass equations for that exactly the same way. So the approaches, or the way to derive mass equation, works for all kinds of systems. The other experiments I wanted to mention was the, but I make it very short, is the double slit. And it's an experiment that did in Vineland's group. So they have a laser. Then they have two atoms trapped in a fixed distance from each other. And then they looked at photon emissions from the atoms. And then they saw a nice interference pattern. So that's also a very nice proof that what you actually see is that atoms are interacting really with all modes of the free radiation field. And if each of them would emit independently, then you wouldn't see, you would see just the same intensity everywhere. But now when you have two atoms and you have an e to the ikr dependence on your Hamiltonian in the beginning, then you see that both of them will contribute to excitations that is later on the screen measured. So the photons don't really exist until they are really measured as clicks on the screen. And then that's another thing they use very much for quantum computing, because what you do is you have one photon source, another photon source, you measure a photon, but you don't know where it came from, and then you manipulate the atoms in that way. So there's also, like Kimball is doing a lot of experiments based on this idea, mainly with, at the moment, with atomic ensembles, but it's a lot of, it's another technique that people in quantum computing use a lot.
In this case, the phase difference between two atoms will only affect the shift this up and down.
Yeah.
But do not, I mean, I guess this is about single shot and multiple shot measurement.
Yeah, you can. What you can do is, you, in the experiment when they did it a few years ago, they put a photographic plate and then collected the clicks of all the photons, and then because these atoms are placed in different positions in the free radiation field, they contribute differently. They like there are places where they constructively interfere to the creation of a photon, and then there are places where you have a minima and you have a destructive interference. Of the, so both photons try to emit there, but they kind of cancel their own contribution, cancel each other, and then you don't have an emission there. So you can really have, and that fits very well with the what I was.
But this is really counting photons over a very long time.
Yeah, yeah. That made it easy to make the experiment, because, or easier because you had to take a picture.
I mean, what will happen if, I mean, I guess how to relate it to quantum jump? If there's a quantum jump, what will I see there?
The quantum jump would come in if you have a, if you make a very weak laser, then you have clicks on the screen. You have really individual clicks, so you have very rare emissions. But if you make, if you have a photographic plate here that then collects all this, then they would end up to an interference pattern in, at the end. It's mainly to show that really, you have a coherent interaction between the laser and the radiation field, and then someone on the outside at the end measures whether there are photons or not.
When you were describing that Dehnholz experiment, you were implying that there's a quantum Zeno effect at work there. Is that true?
Yeah, that's the... this one here, yeah, they used this setup to make a demonstration of the quantum Zeno effect. Because there you measure, you have, in principle, you would expect the atom to go in the time 1 over omega to the excited state. But this quantum jumps or these dark periods are really macroscopic because it takes 1 over omega squared. So they really use that to measure Zeno effect. Yeah. or people in work on the foundations of quantum mechanics, they were, for them it was a big deal to have a proof of this kind of effects and measure, or it made a lot of explained a lot of things about measurements in quantum mechanics.
Is there an experiment on quantum dot?
I think a lot of the experiments that have been done, let's say in the 1980s with single atoms, they are now redone with quantum dots. So like the, for a good reason, because they have to want to prove that they have an artificial atom. So like calculating this, measuring the second order correlation functions. If you go to a conference on quantum dots, you see all these dips all the time. Yeah. And then probably a next step will be to maybe measure some signals like that or some interference effects, yeah. Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah, thanks. Okay.